top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema.
Was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was left living.
His hands. Somebody cut off his hands.
Silent Night, Bloody Night, starring Patrick O'Neill and Astrid Herren.
Yeah, Butler wasn't kidding. Nobody's lived here for years.
Don't laugh at me. I want your ID. Some maniac escaped from Margaretville.
Would you like to drive there?
Also starring John Carradine. Was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was left living. Silent Night. Bloody Night.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 442 of the Really Awful Movies podcast, Silent Night, Bloody Night. Now, I have only the vaguest recollections of renting this on VHS eons ago. I probably would have been in my early teens, but I have nothing committed to the memory banks about what this one entailed. And I think I might have revisited it in snippets, possibly for research for the book Jeff and I co-authored, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, just to, I think, make sure that that one didn't have some sort of kill that we might have overlooked. Because I think as far as a comprehensive kills goes, if we don't say so ourselves, like, this is a pretty definitive guide. Obviously, that book came out in 2016, and there have been probably some really innovative kills subsequently. But that was the last time I really engaged with this film, and only maybe 10, 15 minutes at a time. The beginning, probably little bits in the middle, but I didn't realize to what extent this one had some of the hallmarks of 70s horror. What it does have is that kind of 70s gothic feel, but also a very, very downbeat ending. And I think also incorporating some of the more violent aspects that were becoming de rigueur at the time, that were becoming more in vogue. And so I think it's actually quite a neat fusion of the two. And while it's kind of rooted in the 70s, it has, you know, you can tell it was being sort of pulled in different directions too, even though while it maintained its strong 70s sensibility. And it's worth noting too, and it's something that I completely overlooked, but when you have the kind of a mouth breather collar from the other iconic horror and holiday seasonal horror lensed around this time, I guess 2 years after, which was Bob Clark's Black Christmas, lensed maybe 10, 15 minutes north of where I'm recording this podcast. But it just goes to show how different properties begat different ones, and the almost timeless quality of influence casting the shadow and from one to the next. When you look at Bava's A Bay of Blood from 71, kind of as the blueprint template for slasher films, and then that one being influential to Bob Clark as well. And I think, obviously, the direct line can be drawn of a one-to-one between John Carpenter's Halloween and Black Christmas, of course, too, with only, I think, 3 years in between each one of these things. But, I mean, my God, when you talk about the backstory of A Black Christmas and also the heavily infused backstory of this one, I think you could say that the Clark film, I think, was better structured from a narrative perspective and didn't overly wholly rely on exposition dumps and voiceovers and that, which I think mars the proceedings here in some ways, but doesn't take away from the fact that this one is a really, really creepy, cool atmosphere. And because I've pointed it out as a little irritant of mine, actually has real snow, as befits the location, I think, in Long Island, New York. You gotta love these kinds of 70s horrors, whether it's like a Burnt Offerings, where it has this home that's imbued with this kind of horror, or the Amityville Horror, or one, these kinds of films, because they really have an unmediated kind of sense of place and are grounded in a specific locale that makes it really, really good. And there's a lot of atmosphere that can come from family homes and family dwellings. It's something that I think the star of this kind of film would be, I mean, only because The Shining was a temporary home and actually a hotel, but I think you can make a case that The Changeling was probably the standout of all of these, speaking of Canadian horrors. But there's something about Silent Night, Bloody Night that I still think is a little bit underrated. And they took a lot of interesting stylistic choices and made a lot of interesting strategic storytelling choices that make this warrant a viewing. And I think to modern eyes, its pacing is probably a little bit slower than could be desired. But I think even if you really wanted to, you could up the, it's freely available on YouTube, but you could up the viewing speed to 1.25 if I think that might help maybe a little bit, because there are, it is fairly talky, but also I don't think that's necessarily a debit, because some of the dialogue is kind of stodgy and staid, there's some really wicked moments too. Like, I think one character who's a lawyer says something to the effect of anticipating pleasure can be just as exciting as the pleasure itself. I am paraphrasing here. We're introduced to a lawyer, and it looks like possibly some sort of office fling type relationship with a lawyer going over to settle the estate and the affairs of the Butler family in this big sprawling Long Island, although I think this one's supposed to be set in New England, but a sprawling mansion, and the lawyer goes to settle the affairs and drives up to the home and meets the various townspeople of this small burg in supposedly New England here. And you're introduced to almost like a strange, like almost Fellini-esque introduction to these people, where they have the mayor, the chief of police, and the communications director for the mayor, which is quite absurd because this is a very small town. And they're all speaking in a very across-the-board monotone way and describing how the house that the lawyer is about to visit has been fraught with horror for decades. And it's quite a weird kind of sinister vibe that you're introduced to. And it's kind of unsettling as a viewer, which is obviously the intent, but doesn't also take you away from the proceedings that it's a departure from verisimilitude and realism. It's actually quite effective and quite cool. And the lawyer, you know, introduces himself to all these people, and they have this little back and forth. And soon, before too long, however, the barrister and his love interest, who's played by a German haute couture model by the name of Astrid Haren, who is like just stunningly beautiful. And I don't know to the extent of what other movies she made, but I think she was brought up in England, and her heyday was kind of the late 60s to early 70s, and she's just absolutely stunning. And this duo is murdered with an axe, and we get a sense now of how everything associated and everyone associated with this property is somehow cursed in some way. Now, the home is owned by the Butler patriarch. I think his name is William Butler, who at some point, when we get this backstory, leaves the property to his grandson, who we're introduced to later in the film, played by James Patterson, quite an imposing figure, and who died quite young as well, but who cuts kind of a David Hess, House on the Edge of the Park, Last House on the Left kind of figure, and is really effective here, and gives this film like a real strong grounding, and the performances are really actually quite good across the board, I should say, too. So when you have the barrister murdered, then you have the he was supposed to be the voice and acting as the proxy for the grandson. It just as an aside here, I was going down a rabbit hole, speaking of estates and wills, of different famous golden age of Hollywood estate and will controversies. And I think the most notable one would probably be Joan Crawford, who, if I'm not mistaken, cut out. I want to say her son was Christopher Crawford, but one other, I think she cut out a couple of her kids from the will. And if I'm not mistaken, Jerry Lewis did this as well, which resulted in a lawsuit. I believe he might have had some sort of dispute with an ex-wife as well, and then the son was trying to intercede on behalf of his mother to get her some funds because she had fallen on hard times. These stories are always really, really fascinating when you get to the point where you have a probating of these kinds of estates, or when it's made public as in a will, to see really who is getting what and why. Wills are public domain documents, I think, whereas estates, of which estate dealings, of which wills are a part, are more private. So it's always interesting to see who gets what, and especially when people are older and have tons of money, it's always curious to see how their wealth is disseminated in that. So it's curious and a kind of a neat idea that draws the grandson in, because obviously the lawyer's not answering his calls anymore. And I think the axe murdering scene was quite evocative. And while this film is tame by today's standards and all the bloodletting you might see from the first to two, well, there's going to be a third, like Terrifier movies and whatnot, where it's just grand guignol, blood and guts strewn asunder and about. This one is pretty tame, but I think the axe murdering was very, very evocative and very, very well done, and a lot of quick cuts that betray a kind of Alfred Hitchcockian flair too. And it's weird when this one wears its influences on its sleeve, because some aspects of it almost take on an Orson Welles quality, which is very odd. I mean, this one is a strange beast that if you were to just read it on as a surface level plot, and you hear about this home that is sort of imbued with this curse and it's fraught with peril to anyone who goes there, you could see it would be something along the lines of a Sinister, and it's something a little more straightforward, and something like maybe although it's filled with all kinds of subtext, but the storytelling can be read in a very direct means as well, which would be The Shining, right? But this one has so much more going on and has so much, is so layered, which is why I thought this could have been improved upon with, I think, better storytelling. And nonetheless, we get a lot of really cool touches from, I'm going to butcher his name, but I think the director is Theodore Gerhunty. He was actually ex-husband of the co-star of this film, alongside James Patterson and John Carradine. It was the famous genre actress and the Warhol player, Mary Warrenoff, and very attractive in her own right, especially in this time, player, and best known for, when it comes to our fan base, probably as one of the two perps in Eating Raoul, but also really, really good in the disquieting and very strange hospital healthcare horror called Hellhole. But she's been in tons of different things and really acquits herself very well here as a final girl in a very underrated, very, very good performance as a local who engages with the grandson and helps unravel the kind of doings and the plot. And again, when the lawyer and his paramour are murdered, other people that are associated with the estate begin to meet their maker as well, and being the odd film that it is, we get a strange sepia-toned coda toward the end where it almost has an F. Scott Fitzgerald-esque party, and you know, replete with fine glassware and gloves pulled up to the elbow, and society types who I think were doctors and really whooping it up in the 1920s or 30s, and we find out that there is this elaborate I guess, plan by the owner of the home to turn the homestead into an insane asylum, which is really weird too. And this is something, when you want to draw parallels to other films, obviously, where you have the Michael Myers Institution too, right? And it's always something that's really cool whenever you have references to an insane asylum and you have that kind of backstory. And so this home was home to a bunch of what is later described as inmates. So obviously a lot of terrible things occurred on its premises, and I don't want to divulge too much for those who haven't, like myself, hadn't seen this one in a while, but it is really remarkable. We're going to segue into what we learned, but to the extent this one has kind of an elaborate plotting structure in a way that Sinister doesn't, because in that one Ethan Hawke just finds these old videotapes and then it's mostly straightforward from there. But here we get a lot of backstory, and we get this mouth-breathing caller who identifies themselves as Marianne, and we get an intense incest backstory, and we find out more about Jeffrey Butler and this is the grandson who comes to finalize his family's estate because he needs the money, as he explains to the daughter of the mayor, played by Wernoff. But yeah, we find out more about the backstory and the 15-year-old woman who was raped and sent away, and the denizens of this particular insane asylum. And it's kind of a neat way to describe and tie up the loose ends to this film, because it otherwise could have just been a bunch of jump scares and a bunch of, oh, this home is infused and fraught with these terrible backstory, and then you tie it up with maybe 5 seconds of exposition toward the end. Or if you really wanted to, you could have done something really ambiguous, which is what Stanley Kubrick decided to do in The Shining, where you have those iconic images that we see, again, hearkening back to the Roaring Twenties and the 1930s and that kind of atmosphere in the Overlook Hotel, that giant party room where, obviously Jack Torrance meets Lloyd the bartender, and everyone's seen The Shining, I would hope, by this point. But what was really neat too about this one is it's front end loaded and back end loaded too. So we're introduced to this man on fire and this immolation and this figure crouched who is immolated and on fire and rolls in the snow, and then an immediately effective cut to a hearth and this bucolic holiday Christmas setting and this fireplace, and juxtaposed against this burning image of this man who's, and you don't know to what extent he might have set himself on fire or been the victim of something, and it introduces an ambiguity and a strangeness to Silent Night, Bloody Night that is touched upon later as well. And so while things really get somewhat depressed toward the center, the beginning, as is a really good filmmaking, introduces you to something really punchy and provocative, and then sets the tone and sets the table for something that you're going to really enjoy later on. And the dynamic, it should be said, between the mayor's daughter, Warrenov, and Jeffrey Butler, the James Patterson character, is really, really terrific, because we're introduced to the two of them in her home, and she pulls a pistol out on him because, just for safety reasons, she insists that he show his documentation, just because of the strange doings that she's been a part of. And she's been told ever since she was a young girl in this small town that something evil this way comes, and something evil lurks in that homestead. So she's very, very paranoid. And very, very, has got her guard up. And the two of them have this really amazing connection. And their dynamic is really, really solid, as she becomes a de facto detective and trying to solve this mystery. Again, because you have these elements of the gothic, you have these elements of the slasher, you have this element of a mystery that needs to be solved, but also a few touches of giallo thrown in, sprinkled in for good measure. You definitely have the shots of the black glove and the black glove on the staircase and on the phone, and little stylistic touches of Italian horror sensibilities. I found that dynamic really cool, and I didn't even get to what we've learned here, where there's a definitely an ironic casting of John Carradine as the local almost William Randolph Hearst character here, who's the publisher and owner of the local newspaper, and who communicates to everyone via a bell, almost like the patriarch of the Mexican crime family in Breaking Bad, with that Margolis character with his ding, ding, ding. I forget the actor's first name, but you have that device, and obviously very, very ironic because this is the Carradine patriarch, and obviously a big player in Cecil B. DeMille films, but you know the Carradine acting dynasty is perhaps second only to the Barrymore and is basically Hollywood royalty, but also known for his voice, right? So he is apparently, I think he had a laryngectomy and can only communicate by a notepad. And this can be frustrating to the viewer because he's writing things out as he sees them, but it's also kind of a neat touch too, because he's such an iconic figure, and the dynamics are so great. I mean, Patterson, Woronoff, Carradine, Dynamite, just absolutely great, and of course the aforementioned Astrid Haren, the German knockout, just an absolute beauty. But some really good performances here, and just the weird goings on between the townsfolk and the outsiders and the mayor's daughter and her trying to get to the bottom of this mystery as people increasingly go missing associated with this home, whether it be the police officers or politicians or anyone involved, essentially. So kind of a neat little film here, and it's something way more, it's way more I think, given all the attention that's been granted and bestowed upon the likes of a similarly titled Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2, and kind of the silliness of that one, which I understand, and others as well, whether it's something like a Better Watch Out or It's a Wonderful Knife or any of these countless Christmas slasher type movies, it's easy to forget this little 200,000, PKUN little nothing burgers production from the time. I think probably in today's money it would have been probably like 600,000 or 700,000, but they did a lot with a little and gave this one a real grounding and sense of place and time. And you know, obviously you'd quibble with the storytelling mechanisms, because I think they could have, they painted themselves into a corner and required Woronoff's character to really go haywire with the exposition toward the end. And I think they probably could have told things using a different means. And, you know, in addition to the voiceovers, there's the cliche of the using the newspaper article as a way to convey information previously heretofore unknown, and not necessarily the greatest, but there's a little kernel of a gem of a fun little movie in here, and I think more people should see it. And while I appreciate Bob Clark's Black Christmas, and a dynamite film that one is, I think I never realized to the extent this was it really had its punchy and evocative and cool little sleek moments too. And I thought, man, this was really, really good. I think maybe 3.25 is probably fair if we're going to get down to judging it because of some of its the storytelling flaws. But you just can't go wrong with these genre icons here, and little snippets and little tidbits of really quite good atmosphere, whether it's using candlelight or the lights of a police siren to light a scene. Really, really neat stuff. And a neat scene that I won't spoil either, on the roadside, involving the Carradine Toden figure, I believe, or Towson, I forget the name of the publisher, but all these different disparate elements, all these different influences, and ultimately a finished product that's very, very worthy of your time and worthy of the holiday season. So stay safe, everyone. Have an excellent Christmas. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Mm-hmm.